G'day folks, welcome to Stick With It, APA's podcast for its pilots. Today I'm joined by Captain Andrew Stead. He's Qantas's Head of Check and Training. Many of you would know him as Steady. And he's with us today to talk a bit about, again, training and preparing yourself for training, managing some of the hiccups that may go along the way. And we'll also finish off with a bit of an update as where EBT is at the moment. So welcome to you, Steady.
Thank you very much, Mark. And thank you for the invitation to come and talk. It's always good to talk about our training systems and get rid of some of the myths and misconceptions maybe.
So I guess I'll start with your, obviously you're probably running at a million miles an hour, and one of the things that's causing that is the new training facility in Sydney. So how is that coming along?
Yeah, it's progressing really well. It's actually already operational right now, the A321 simulator, and its cockpit procedures trainer have been certified and are actually already being used. Mm-hmm. I got some news yesterday that the A380 simulator has arrived. It's in pieces, but it has arrived, and it should be up and running by the 3rd of September. So the building itself is very close to being, you know, fully functional and operational for us to start seeing training occur in Sydney again. And I think it'll be well received when people do see the facility, because it is quite modern and new and has the right technology and equipment and break rooms that we would all expect.
Excellent. So once it's up and running at its sort of as planned capacity, how many sims are going to be located back in Sydney?
It has capacity for 8 simulators in total. So that gives us a little bit of growth room from what we currently have. So all of the current types will have a presence, a full flight simulator presence in Sydney. So the 73, A330, 78, A380, as well as the A320 I just mentioned. There's space for a 350. And if people are following the maths, there should be two additional bays for TBA, you know, some other simulators to be advised in the near future.
Okay. So I know that the new training year is underway and hundreds of courses, both conversion and promotional, are planned. So from your experience, what advice do you have for upcoming trainees regarding the best way to prepare for their course?
Yeah, no, great question. Because look, very cognizant that for many people out there turning up to training to do a new course, be it a conversion or a promotional course, is potentially a point of stress in their lives maybe, or a bit of apprehension. And I really don't want that to be the case. But what can be done, I think, is a sort of like a mutual contract. We absolutely, as a training organization, are there to help, guide, teach, learn, and develop everybody as they go through our training programs. But obviously, if the trainee turns up prepared, it makes that journey a lot better. And that's kind of the contract we're looking to create. So from a preparation perspective, I'd say twofold. One is you want to find the balance from not doing too little and then doing too much is also just as bad. You don't need to turn up knowing every single little thing. As I said, the training department is there to train and teach. Equally, you don't need to have prepped for your final command simulator when you're turning up for your first round of ground school simulators. So it's a journey. So you just need to be prepared. And we always talk about when you are learning your skills, your foundational skills are basically knowledge and those SOPs. So if you're spending time looking at your FAM and understanding that that policy that applies to all of our operations today, if you have a look at then some normal procedures, and by normal procedures I mean the way you would structurally handle some abnormal, these things will hold you in good stead. And then the last thing I'd say is having just to think about your management structure and your management framework. And you might have, I'm sure everybody's aware, there's already some guidance starting to come out in FSOs, and we'll follow up in some formal company documentation about some examples of management frameworks. But if you have a think about that, if you prepare with some basic knowledge around your FAM and your normal procedures that you're going to, have a really good think about how you manage the processes, I think that's the best preparation you can possibly do. And just the last bit would be then don't need to overdo it, because sometimes it's a marathon and there's no point burning yourself out at the beginning.
Yeah, it feels to me, you know, you're not expected to be proficient. What you're expecting on sim one is not, you know, the journey in terms of where you need to be. You don't need to be at that capability on day one, basically. So don't try and burn, as you say, burn yourself out by being too stressed too early. Now,
Mark. And none of the instructors are thinking that as well. So that's we want to go on that journey with you.
Excellent. Now, in terms of pre-reading, where can our members, you know, access information about training paths and pre-reading if they did want to, you know, get a little bit ahead of the game?
No, yeah, look, and it's a good idea to have a look at the training path because it gives you a bit of an idea of what your life is going to look like over the next few weeks and months, and probably have those discussions with your family as well about some expectations. So, look, the training paths can all be found on QF Flight Crew or through the terminal on QF Flight Crew. And if you go to the training tab, you'll see in the after the training tab, there'll be a section called training paths. You go to the training path there and look, you might be a little bit inundated with a sea of numbers, but at the top of the page, you'll see a decoding system that will tell you how the key works for those numbers. And then that will basically direct you to the path if you haven't already been shared it as part of your, you know, coursework that's been sent to you.
So why are there so many different training paths? Can you explain to us, I guess, why there are so many different numbers and different ways that someone can get from one aircraft type to another?
Yeah, it seems a bit counterintuitive sometimes, doesn't it? And sometimes those training paths are actually very, very similar. Look, it's twofold. One is that we recognize that where people come from, their skill sets, their previous types, etc., might mean that there's an opportunity to take some credit for that, some recognition of prior learning, if you will. Yep. And so therefore we'll have courses that respect the fact that you have got no prior experience on this type, so there's a full course. Or there might be some other adjustments based on the fact that you've flown the manufacturer before, Boeing or Airbus, and you're moving between the same type. So each and every training path is trying to sort of predict what your experience levels are and then sort of help to tailor a course then that would best benefit you as an individual. I say that, I caveat that with, obviously, then it also often depends with who you're paired up with. So sometimes we try to pair people up together who have similar backgrounds, because then we can put them through that training path. So that's the first step. It's really just as simple as that, trying to create as close to a bespoke course as we can based on an individual skill set. And then the second part is for tracking. So our systems, we want to track how our people go through the systems. And so we need sort of an individual code, if you will, for each training path, because they all have slightly different time lengths, et cetera, and, you know, various simulators and line training requirements. And as a system, we need to be able to track that and program that. And so we just need a separate code for each one.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Now, I know that training courses overseas have become part of the norm. I know some trainees might think going to Singapore and eating fatties every day would be awesome, and then someone else thinks it might put a bit of an undue burden on their family. So can people put in a request for, you know, to stay in Australia, or dare I say it, they want to go overseas, or do they really just have to take where they're given?
Look, 100%, I recognise it's sometimes a bit of a polarising position, you know, the overseas course. Some people love it, other people it is a burden. I completely acknowledge that. Yep. Look, I think the simple answer I might just start with is that, look, as a training organisation, we don't want to send people overseas. In fact, it's not the way we're trying to set ourselves up long term ever. It's a burden to many, it's an additional cost to the company, and it does actually introduce some inefficiencies into our training program. So we don't do it because we want to do it, we're doing it because we've got a volume of training that we have to do. So we're always going to be trying to bring people back on shore. Where there's on an individual fleet, where we might be seeing some people doing onshore courses and some people doing offshore courses, and the 737 was a good classic case where some have been doing it onshore because there's capacity, and others we've sent to Dallas. That nobody can. We're not going to force you. I mean, if you've got very, very good reasons why you can't go, we're going to work with you to find the right solution. So all we ask is that you let us know as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. What doesn't help us is when somebody tells us just prior to leaving. That's from a planning perspective is very difficult. But with enough prior notice, enough prior warning, our team and the flight training schedulers are always looking to how we can best accommodate the training program for everybody. It doesn't do us a service if we're sending people there and they're already in the wrong mindset and in the wrong mindset to do this training program. Now, there is a however, right? And maybe the however part is there are some fleets, and now I'm going to pull out the A330. The A330, unfortunately, right now, is a fleet where we don't actually have a presence on shore to do initial courses. The volume of training is so large at the moment for the 330 that we are sending almost all of our training overseas. So we lose a little bit of that flexibility to sort of adjust the courses for the individuals who turn up for the 3:30. What I can say, though, is we can absolutely talk to people about when and where. And if, again, the more notice, more beneficial and the easier it is for us to plan. Yep. With some notice, we can maybe adjust when you would leave to find the right time that would suit the various participants, et cetera. So we have plans to bring a large portion of our A330 back on shore by around April, May next year. We should be seeing a lot of that offshore presence reduce. But currently at the moment, yeah, the A330 does have a very large offshore presence. And our best thing we can offer is that we'll be cognizant of people's needs about when is maybe the best time to go overseas.
Yeah, so basically pick up the phone and talk to the training team. And then you guys can work together to try and optimize the situation, given the limitations that are in place at the moment. That sounds pretty reasonable.
Exactly, exactly. And we'll put together the where we are and what our constraints are, and then we'll try and find something that works for both parties.
Okay, thank you for the explanation. Now, you know, a person gets on a training course and, you know, something may flare up at home. You know, your personal life can be relationship, could be the health of a child, whatever the issue is. Again, you know, we've had examples where people think, no, I'm just going to put the crash helmet on and try to get through it. And often that has ended not the way they'd hoped for. If someone raises their hand and says, look, I need some help, is that going to jeopardize their training slot?
Absolutely not. And I'm actually really glad you raised that, because on twofold, you just mentioned there that, you know, sometimes people just try to push their way through it, and sometimes that's when things unravel and it doesn't work so well. And we only find out about this life event when it starts unraveling. It does everybody a disservice. It does the individual a disservice. Put your hand up early when something's happening. And then the second part is, one of the things I've always thought Qantas has done a very, very good job of is when there are serious life events for people, because we absolutely understand that, you know, your life is more important than the job. And so, yes, we ask of you to travel. We ask you to go overseas. We ask a lot of you to get through these courses in a timely manner with us. But when there's serious events in your life, which do happen, we will help you. So, no, we will put your hand up as soon as you know about something, have a talk to the training managers, and then let us figure out a good solution to support you.
Okay, now that's, again, very good advice. Now, can you share with us, I guess, some of the common mistakes is maybe a bad word, but I guess I'm just curious, you know, where people maybe do experience struggles in the training. Is there common themes to sort of areas where people maybe do struggle?
Yeah, it's a common question, Mark. Probably a tricky one to answer, because it is quite variable. Just prior to coming onto the podcast, I thought I should just double check a small fact. And you know, we're doing sort of upwards of 30,000 training events for our pilots per annum. Now, that's obviously individual events. So that's a lot of events, and there can be a lot of different reasons why people maybe have some struggles in different parts. But if I was to give my personal view, and I've been instructing for a long time, I feel like there maybe is two main areas, and they're almost counterintuitive. On one area is there's the lack of preparation. There's the people turn up and they haven't done the preparation prior, and they find that, you know, the course is long and that they are struggling to keep up with the demands of you know, keep, you know, looking ahead for the next session and learning the content because they haven't done the prior preparation. So they haven't got those foundational skills locked away, and therefore they're finding it hard to do that value-adding kind of prospect of the training. The second group, I would say, are the people who, if I was to say, maybe are done too much preparation and are overthinking everything, and they're kind of looking for the, you know, the missing the woods for the tree kind of analogy. Yep. That they focus on get focus on very minute details, but they miss the big picture. And then I would honestly say what we're looking to create are, you know, highly skilled, competent, safe pilots. But then that's the standard. That's what everyone's going to say. And then what the Qantas sort of standard on top of that is, you know, we've got, you know, highly skilled pilots who manage the situation well, who work with the crew well, who involve everybody within the flight deck and in the cabin and externally to the aircraft well. And that often requires that ability to take that step back and not get lost in the minutia. So I'd say this is more my personal perspective, but I think when we do see people come through our system who fall over, they kind of fall into those two camps in the most common areas.
What you just talked about is a little bit thematic to the next question about the command management sims, which always seem to fill trainees with a bit of dread. Have you got some insight into how to best prepare and approach those sims?
Yeah, look, you're not wrong. Look, and it wasn't that long ago I did my command sims as well, so I know how we often see them as this hurdle we have to get across, and what we have to do, and perhaps make them into quite a big event in our life as we go through the promotional course. Look, what I'd say, Mark, my advice with this is look at the command sims as an opportunity to learn and develop your skill sets as well. They are a really wonderful opportunity to be a little bit pushed and challenged. The point of a command simulator is to push and challenge you. I think the way I look at it is, I think we can all think to those events we've had occur online at various stages where we have been pushed and challenged. They don't happen every day, but they do happen across our careers. And we can probably think back on whether they've been managed well or haven't been managed well, and we'll take lessons from both. We'll get the lessons from when we've either done it ourselves or seen somebody else manage that situation really well, or maybe it's been the opposite and we learn, you know, that's not the way I would do things. So obviously, as we're trying to put people through this course, and we do see, look, you know, the command in Qantas is a huge milestone in somebody's career. We want it to be a meaningful, valuable thing in somebody's personal, professional development, but also, of course, we're basically giving you command of an aircraft and all the regulatory responsibilities that go with it. We need to have a couple of sims that we're going to push and stretch the crew to sort of see what their structures are like, what their management structures are like. So that's where the preparation is most beneficial. It's that management structure. So you've got the ability to delegate duties, because you'll have to do everything in this. You'll have to have a better degree of the manipulation and the systems knowledge of the aircraft, but then have that capacity to then manage the situation. So where you can have a think about those management frameworks again, how you would go about it is, I think, the best preparation you can do, thinking about the management, those management frameworks. But then what I would say is, do not see each one of those command sims as, I can't make a mistake, or I can't, you know, I have to be perfect. Of course you can. Of course you will. We all do. And there's lots of great learning. So then talk to your instructor, listen to the feedback from the instructor as you go through it, and use it, like I said in the beginning, as, I've gone through this maybe sort of challenging simulator. What can I learn from it? What can I learn that went well? And what can I learn that maybe didn't go as well that I can improve on? And I think if you do that and you see it as a process, a step along the way, they won't seem as big a hurdle to get across.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember with mine, it was sort of, you come up with a management structure after the first sim, and then you threw about half of it out after the first sim and tweaked it. And it was almost, you were just constantly making adjustments through those sims and to get it to a spot that you were happy with. But as you said, it wasn't like trying to be perfect on the first sim. It was an evolution through those sims.
Exactly. And honestly, and with a lot of conscious thought, and I think you'll get onto evidence-based training in the near future, we are big believers in the training department of EBT, because we think it's going to aid in people's management, developing their management structures, developing how to respond in a slightly unknown and maybe slightly stressful situation. We think that can only provide a benefit for the command simulators, because it should just be a natural extension.
Now, option Bs can happen. We all know about that. Can you explain and give, I guess, a bit of an insight into what a trainee can expect in the event that they receive an option B, and any advice that you've got on how they should manage this from a trainee perspective?
An option B, I suppose I'd like to sort of straight away point out that it's not a failure. Like, an option B does not mean failure. It you failed. An option B means, you know, you haven't met the requirements of that particular session at that particular time. And the option B does another thing. It obviously then flags as a system to the training managers that this has occurred and that there's maybe some sort of some gaps we need to look at developing and closing. So that's the point of an option B, is really to let the training department know that certain elements within that session haven't quite reached the proficiency level that we have needed to see. And then we go away as a training department, or the training managers will then go away and try to figure out, well, what's the best way we can develop the pilots and close those gaps and help them. Now, obviously, and I'll, because I don't just want to leave it there, because obviously, look, if there's a number of option Bs, there is a point where we do stop training. But before that occurs, we've gone through many iterations of those option Bs. And in each and every one of those occasions, there's always new training paths created, new training sessions created, all designed to help the person, you know, overcome whatever those issues have been that have been identified that haven't quite met the standards we've needed at the day. So I suppose it's easier said than done, but I suppose what my advice to people, if you do get an option B, do not see it as like some failure and my course is over and the whole, and or as I often hear, that the whole training department's now scrutinizing them and looking at them. That's not the case. What it is just a mechanism for us to sort of understand, okay, maybe then we need some more help in these areas. And then we try to go away and create and develop the right pathway for them. But I'll also put this in context, because again, I did a little bit of research. I think I mentioned that we have roughly about 30,000 odd training events per annum. We have around about 200 odd option Bs per annum. So you try to put that in the context. We're looking at under 1% of the training events drive an option B. Now, on another aspect, and from our training department side, yeah, almost one a day is coming through on average. So, you know, a bit under, but you know what? Yeah, certainly every 3 days, we're probably getting two option Bs. So we deal with them regularly, but that does not mean that they're a very common thing.
Now, I guess the interesting thing with that as well, though, is that because they're not common, when they do happen, I'm guessing in the trainee's head, it lands like a tsunami. So I guess the thing is, if a person is struggling to deal with that option B, and what mechanisms are in place? I mean, are they allowed to put their hand up? And I mean, one of the things I would recommend to them is, if they need to, they get in touch with APA's welfare team. But I'm just, you know, from your perspective, it is okay, isn't it, to I know rationally what you've just said makes perfect sense, but obviously emotionally there still is potentially a person really can struggle with it, and just trying to get a sense of your thoughts on how to, if they are struggling with that, what they should do to try and then manage that.
No, you're absolutely right, Mark. I mean, you know, we all put a lot of pressure on ourselves, and we're all obviously, you know, are professionals. And so, yeah, often when we get these, it's a lot easier to stay how the system works, but how you emotionally feel about it can be a very different thing. So no, absolutely, you can put your hand up. And look, I agree, reach out to APA Welfare or PAN or EAP or any of those providers of, you know, sort of, I would say, an anonymous help that is provided, is offered out there to sort of help support you. Beyond that too, though, speak to your friends, speak to the training managers. I mean, nobody is ever going to, actually, I was about to go down a line there. I was going to say, but the respect that people will get when somebody says, I need some help, or I'd like to talk through something, or I'm feeling this way, you will always find that you're going to get a good reception when the person wants to understand how they can best get through it. So, yeah, please put your hand up and speak to the right person for you that thinks it's going to give you the support that you need. And yeah, if that's through an APA Welfare or a PAN, or if it's going to the training managers themselves and just trying to talk things through, I know they're very open to it.
Now, from your perspective, is there much difference between preparing for, say, SIM sessions versus when you finally get out of the box and you go online? Is there much of a difference in your perspective of training, of preparing for those different types of training?
There shouldn't be, but of course there is. obviously the simulator, if we're talking about going through a course, the simulator focus is designed to equip you to fly the aircraft out on the line, but it's also allowing us to go through lots of abnormals, lots of systems knowledge, and, you know, and potentially put you into some situations where we have to really sort of test some of those decision-making skills. So, yeah, I would suggest that you are doing within your simulator preparation a lot of diving into the systems and the non-normals, et cetera. But of course, that's all laid out in the lesson plan. So we're not sort of asking you to sort of not giving you a guide. The guide's there. The lesson plans are there. And then, of course, there's method to our madness. We're now building those skill sets up into with you so that the idea is you've now got some of those foundational skills once you move to the line. So you don't need to spend as much time diving into the systems and the abnormals because you've done that through the simulators. So once you get to the line, yeah, you want to look at how best to approach the operational side of things. Often there too, a lot of the AIP, which, you know, to be fair, the FAM covers absolutely almost all of the AIP that we need to know as pilots in Qantas. So having that FAM application, that FAM knowledge, how to then apply the practicalities of our fuel policy and those decision makings, and then integrating the cabin, which is a, you know, our instructors do their best at at trying to act what's happening in the cabin, but it can't beat what actually happens in the real life. Yep. So there should sort of form part of your preparation towards the line.
Now, I know we've focused a lot on, feels like, the negative aspect of training and how to manage it, but it's not all bad, is it?
No. And I think, look, I'm biased, of course. So, but I think, you know, if you speak to most instructors within Qantas, you know, one of the reasons why they're an instructor in Qantas is they have a large amount of pride in both what they do and what Qantas is and what Qantas has been as a training organization. And they want to maintain that. I mean, our goal is to get people through our system, to train them up and develop them and make them really, really great professional pilots. And we do a really good job of that. I mean, if I was to look at what we have just come through this financial year, we did almost 700 training events. Now, that's a record in any training year in Qantas. But that means 700 people have come through our system and they've, you know, started on a new type as a second officer, or they've been promoted, or they've changed types. And, you know, it's a big success story. So, you know, there's very few who don't get through our courses, because, like I said, we are there to try and help people get through. And then I think and I hope a lot of people, as they come through our system, will actually look back and they've been sort of can reflect back on some of the learnings they've received from the instructors, because they see within those instructors that there's a lot of pride in what they're trying to deliver. And our whole goal is to develop the pilots who go through the training system. And again, I'm biased, but I've had an opportunity to spend some time with other training departments around the world as well. And I really am, having seen that, I'm actually very, very proud and confident to say that we have a good standard in Qantas, and that's the whole goal of trying to develop the pilots here.
I'm guessing it's only going to get busier, so I wish you luck.
Yes, it is, Mark. There's lots more training to come.
Now, we were going to have Dirk Darman, I call him friend of the show, on, but he's stuck flying a 380 today, so you're stepping into the breach with a couple of EBT questions. So we're now into the third semester of the EBT cyclic series, I believe. And are you able to give us a bit of an update on how the EBT rollout is continuing?
Yeah, look, I love the fact that that Dirk was supposed to be talking about this and then just pulled out at the last minute. He's the expert. But no, look, happy to. So yeah, look, we have gone through our three semesters and about to just sort of start into our fourth semester of EBT. From our perspective, it's been a huge success. And I'm not going to say that we're not learning lessons along the way and we're making some adjustments, and I can speak to those if you'd like. But absolutely, I think it's achieving what we want. The first thing I'd say is through our new Prodefus, our new technology interaction about how to conduct the cyclics for our instructors, there's a feedback mechanism. I think we've all seen the emails after you do your cyclic, you kind of get badgered to put some feedback in. But what that has done is we have a really rich set of feedback from our pilots as they go through the system, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yep.
In our previous feedback systems, they were there, but they were very rarely used. So the technology has really helped us to have a good feedback mechanism. And by and large, it's really positive. We're getting some really good feedback that people are turning up feeling less stressed, which is a good thing, before their cycliques, that they're walking out feeling like they've learnt things from the cyclique, and they've been challenged, which is kind of ticking all the boxes that we're trying to do. I think when we first introduced it, and I did listen to Dirk's first podcast, trying to talk about how we're, you know, trying to take away some of the fear of the unknown, because we know we're putting people into an environment of maybe some variability, and they can't prepare for the simulators like they used to. And I would hope, and I think we've seen through, you know, three semesters now, that people have seen that, no, it's actually not a bad thing turning up with less knowledge of what's about to occur, and then testing your processes, testing your management structures, and then learning from it, and that we as a training department are actually on that journey with you as well. Mm-hmm. So, no, from my perspective, it's been a really good success. We've seen our grading sort of be very consistent, and which means for me is that it means our instructors across all the different fleets are sort of engaging with EBT and that facilitated discussion, that grading structure, you know, in a consistent manner, which is good because we don't sort of then get some sort of outliers. And our focus actually now is on how we can roll EBT out wider within the training department, so into other areas of our training, like command training and route checks, and into AST and into, you know, EP's training, etc.
Yep. So in terms of the feedback you received, has that changed sort of the way that you're running cyclics? Has any of that been integrated into that new cyclic program?
Absolutely. So one example I might share is we just ran a scenario, for example, where our second officers did a low visibility sequence in the evaluation phase that was in semester three. Now, as probably most people who are listening to this will be aware, our second officer cohort do exactly the same scenarios as our captains and FOs, and we did that on purpose because the idea is to develop our pilots and to prepare them for the next stage in their career. But some of the feedback that came back was saying not that doing low visibility sequences is inappropriate for our second officer cohort, but is doing it in the evaluation phase the most appropriate point, where that's the evaluation phase, as people hopefully are aware, is where the instructor kind of sits back and watches and observes to try and take a pulse of what the standard is before we get into the training and the development side of things. So would that low visibility scenario be better off maybe in day two in a scenario where there can be some evaluating, some training? And I think as we as a cohort have looked at that and gone, yes, we agree with that. Some of that feedback's come through. That's probably more appropriate for our second officer cohort who don't do low visibility operations sitting in the front seat, as and it is certainly a little bit more unfamiliar to them. Yep. That maybe it's more appropriate where we would like the instructor to actually add some value to that scenario. So better to move it into maybe day two where we can actually do that. So that's one example of some consistent feedback we got through semester three that we've taken on board and agree with, and we'll design our new courses with that in mind.
Okay. Now, can you give us a bit of a sneak peek into what the focus will be for the upcoming EBT semesters, or is that a tightly guarded secret?
Actually, I wish I knew. So if it's a secret, it's something I'm not privy to. We have a team, you know, it was led by Dirk. So Dirk's now handing that over to Jeremy Sutherland to take over. And there's James Roston and Dwayne Moffat and a few others are sort of working together to create our EBT scenarios. And then they work with each individual fleet. So each individual fleet has some lesson plan riders. And we go through workshops prior to the semester starting, where we map out what it is that we are looking to achieve. We design the scenarios where it will take place. And then we, you know, figure out some of those branch points on the variables along the way. And we do that as a group so there's consistency across all the fleets, and we're providing a very consistent EBT experience for everybody. That team has, you know, it has just about to start on semester five. I actually don't know what they're up to with it at the moment. I will get pulled into it at some point, but they're working through that, and they're going to start on the design process through semester five. If anybody, but it's not that much of a secret, because if anybody is really interested, if you have a look in our training and checking manual and you look in the appendix, there will be the matrix that we work to. Now, the matrix won't say exactly, it's not like the old matrices that says you in this session you'll do a V1 cut, et cetera, but it does group what will be done in each semester around the various competencies and that need to be looked at. And that comes out of the EBT ICAO guide. We've followed an ICAO model for EBT. So it'll talk about, is there going to be an adverse weather element or a terrain element or a surprise element or a malfunction element? It'll talk about those things. So if anybody is really keen, they can be happy to go have a look at our training and checking manual and they'll see what's coming up for semester five.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. Now, you did allude to it before, but do you think EBT will ever sort of become integrated into promotional or conversion training, or is it still just really going to live in the cyclic world?
No. Yeah. Our goal is to broaden it out. Certainly, the concepts of introducing EBT obviously introduces a structural change for our occurrence about variability and surprise, but it's also about building up those decision-making skills and the frameworks and really trying to stretch the pilot. But it's also how the instructor interacts with the trainees. So, you know, making sure it's through adult learning concepts, facilitation of the discussions, facilitation of the outcomes. So maybe I'll frame it this way. We want aspects of EBT to go all the way through every single part of training. Yep. So whether it's type ratings, command trainings, writ checks, we'll use aspects of EBT throughout that because we see the benefit of that adult learning. We see the benefit of facilitation. We see the benefit of giving the trainee the right environment to learn. Some elements, though, might structurally have to be a little bit more similar to what they are today. When you're doing a type rating, it's still going to be very much about that foundational knowledge and skills and systems. So it might not change as much there. But yeah, command training. Yeah, I think we were looking at the moment to look towards command training simulators that are more variable, you know, as opposed to as structured as they are today. We would like to look at introducing the competency-based assessment into our route checks rather than using at the moment what is currently, you know, the sort of the more sequence or task-based sequenced assessment we have in route checks about, you know, the climb, the cruise, the descent, you know, going actually more for the competency assessment. And right now we have a program that's occurring where we're looking at when for our instructor training, we want to use EBT competencies and a few other, like four additional ICAO EBT competencies for how we assess our instructors through their instructor training. So rather than, again, being more task-based and sequence-based with instructors, we want to sort of look to them in the same lens. You know, what are their communication skills like, their teamwork like, their and then we have some additional instructor competencies to go along with it, but use that framework. So that's a bit of a long answer, but it's we have plans to take everywhere in training, but it's just not necessarily going to look exactly the same as it does in recurrent training.
No, long answer, but a good one. So thank you for that. You've channeled Dirk well. Now, I guess just to wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Does he speak longer?
No comment. But is there anything else you'd like to add just before we wrap up today?
I'd like to say thank you. And I'd like to say thank you actually to you know, both our instructors and the trainees who are going through it. I mean, we alluded to, you know, 700 training events. There are more coming. It's a really actually exciting time, to be honest. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of change. And there's a lot of opportunities. But as a training system, you know, that's puts a lot of pressure on us. And so the fact that we're achieving what we're achieving and getting people through and, you know, getting the 30,000 odd training events and relatively small numbers of option Bs is a testament to all the instructors who put in all the hard work they've been doing, and they're working really hard. And the trainees who are turning up and they're turning up, you know, and working through the courses with us. We know we're overseas a lot at the moment, and that is challenging for many, and people are getting through that and helping us get through that. And so I'd like to say thank you, and I hope the outcome of that is that though people are getting some great opportunities to change aircraft types, get promotions and do some really positive things. And there's more of that to come, but I also appreciate that it's been a lot of hard work for everybody. So just thank you.
All right. So, well, thanks again for your time as well. I know you're very busy with all that stuff that's going on. So we really appreciate your insights and explanation of what's going on. So thank you very much to you, and I'll wish you all the best as you move forward. So thanks, Steady.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for the invitation to talk.
No
problem.
Appreciate it. No worries. That's it for today. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another podcast. In the meantime, fly safe and stick with it.